thanks for coming along tonight. It's the first occasion on which the Sydney Institute's run late. I got a bit confused about the starting time, but I'm blaming it all on postmodernism. I think it's we're not really late. We're only sort of late if you think we're late, and if you don't think we're late, we're not late. So we're on time, and yeah, and we have a copy of David Malou's most recent book. So look, we're all here, and I would be sorry if there was such a concept as sorry, since there isn't. What's the point? Now. Not helped by the fact that we've had our granddaughters at the office, which has made life even more confusing in a kind of most postmodernist kind of way. So look, Ihab Hassan makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He spoke here a couple of years ago on the concept of postmodernism. I remember Bob Carr, who was then Premier, ringing me up after saying it was the best thing he'd read on it. Ihab's back in Australia and said he'd like to come along to the Sydney Institute, and he'd like David Malouf to come along too. And David Malouf's been here on a number of occasions, and of course, including the time when he gave our annual lecture, which was a great success, I think about a decade ago now, about that, yeah. So we'll start off with Dr. Hassan, and then we'll follow up with David Malouf. The general topic is fundamentalism and literature. They'll both talk for about 20 minutes each. We'll have time for questions and discussion and finish no later than 7 o'clock. And I'd just like to say thanks to Clayton for the use of this facility. We have got a postmodernist tape recorder, which may or may not work, but folks, it doesn't matter. Okay. Dr. Hassan, thanks.
Thank you for inviting me once again to the Sydney Institute and in such good company. Everything I have to say tonight could be subsumed by a wisecrack of Mark Twain. He said, "What gets us into trouble is not what we don't know, it's what we know for sure and just ain't so." But to subsume everything with a wisecrack, however wise, is reductive. Kind of parlor fundamentalism, if you wish. So I'll have to skip from Hannibal, Missouri to Kyoto, Japan. Why? Because at the Zen temple of Ryoanji, there are 15 rocks that stand in a raked, undulating bed of sand, evoking an endless sea. They stand artfully so that no viewpoint can reveal all 15 rocks at one glance. A pragmatist like William James might simply remark that we lack the perspective, but alas, not the desire, to grasp the world as a single fact. The rocks themselves make no remarks. I'd like to take a hint from that garden. I will offer no overall view of the subject. I only invite you to stroll among some rocks without leaving footprints in the sand. Let's walk now toward the second rock, since I began with the first. Now, what's fundamentalism? I can't define it. If you look it up, you'll meet the Latin fundus, basics and bottoms, first principles and animal posteriors. You'll meet for sure not one but many kinds of fundamentalisms. At the University of Chicago, for instance, the theologian Martin Marty has edited 5 obese volumes titled The Fundamentalism Project. As for literature, we all know what incorrigible shifter that is. Fundamentalism and literature, the tyrant and the trickster. Is literature then really the antithesis of fundamentalism, the sworn enemy, like Shia against Sunni, or the Hatfields and McCoys in the hills of Kentucky? Not quite. Now, it's true that I think of fundamentalism as a kind of brazen tower, proud and violent against life, against nature. And it's true again that I think of literature as a rainbow cloud, a kaleidoscope, a pleasure dome, refracting certainty, scattering power, coloring the sky. But dichotomies, divisions like that, simplify. We are 2 steps away from fundamentalism. Why? Because though literature may challenge dogmas, there are commitments also, deep commitments, that quicken literature. And because literature has its own absolutism, believe it or not, just as fundamentalism has its poetry of beliefs. So let's skip this and let's keep free and loose. Three, rock three. But look, who speaks here? Who speaks about keeping loose? Me. The question is relevant, especially for writers, critics, intellectuals, academics, because the late Edward Said thought that the duty of the intellectual is to speak truth to power. Certainly. But more difficult still is speaking truth to yourself. Call it thinking against oneself. And that's what I want to try to do now in a thumbnail memoir. During my adolescence in Egypt, sometime between 1940 and 1942, yes, the numbers are right, between 1940 and 1942, I became suddenly and insufferably devout. I prayed, turning my face toward Mecca. I fasted through the month of Ramadan, and I pointed my finger at hypocrisy and corruption everywhere, especially under the nose of my parents, who were Muslim by birth but never practiced Islam. In other words, I experienced fundamentalism as a kind of purity and wore it as a halo of adolescent rebellion. Needless to say, my parents were not amused, but that was precisely the point, wasn't it? I did not join the Muslim Brotherhood simply because I'm not a joiner. I didn't inhale, as President Clinton had said. But I could have joined, as did some friends at the University of Cairo. Of course, the Brotherhood was relatively benign in those days. Its shibboleth, its slogan, was Islam is the solution. And that shibboleth had not caught fire yet and laid parts of the earth waste. My point is simply this. At a certain stage, fundamentalism, Muslim or Christian or Marxist, appears as a form of idealism, a kind of self-transcendence, as well as a means of rebellion against the perceived depravity of the adult world. More, fundamentalism satisfies the need for self-assertion through self-sacrifice. Isn't that something? Four, that was then, fundamentalism as adolescent panache. And now, in the non-Western world, that is, in the largest moiety of the earth, fundamentalism still draws on delayed hopes, but also on archaic drives. Tribalism, nationalism, religious sectarianism, the claims of identity, the abhorrence of modernization, a post-colonial backlash, a need for both redress and revenge among the poor, the scorned, and the infirm who know only how to die. Thus, youthful panache becomes fanatic, even terrorist. Nietzsche, with his eyes rolling, offers here an insight. Idealism, he thought, bends easily to spite. Utopianism bends to tyranny. And nihilism infects the fanatic. The latter, the fanatic, lacks the affect of command, that's his phrase. Hypnotically, the fanatic subjects himself to a larger will. In a blazing trance, the fanatic turned terrorist steps forward to answer the call. I am nothing. I give myself to all. Boom! What transcendent pride. But let's be fair. The fanatic idealist may answer also another call, that of abysmal sympathy rather than transcendent pride. Here, Kierkegaard, not Nietzsche, is our man. Kierkegaard was drawn to anguish, to the extreme anguish of Abraham or of Job. Call it the Job complex, a dread of not suffering, a fear of not suffering. In plain words, abysmal sympathy leads us to embrace the pain of others, boils, stench, ashes, and afflictions all. Can the violence of some religious fundamentalists come from acute identification with the pain of a people or a group? Is it due to some exorbitant guilt or to a sentiment even more complex and shady than guilt? I can't answer. I amble now toward the fifth stone. Five. At this point, someone like myself, actually, cries out, hold on, not all Muslims are fundamentalists, let alone terrorists. Indeed, yes, sure. In the mainstream of Islam runs a moderate reformist current driven by middle-class aspirations. It is moderate yet stubborn, and women are crucial to it. That is why I must advert now to ladies' fashions and lingeries. Not long ago, I happened upon a BBC program about two Istanbul fashion designers, one secular, the other religious. The first designed sexy underwear, the second Islamic scarves and Turkish burqas. Both were successful, the second increasingly so, the Islamist. It was a tale of two cities, two ways of being in the world, of fulfilling legitimate desires, those of the body and those of the spirit. Now, to my surprise, I found myself more drawn to the Islamic designer, his quiet dignity and stolid beliefs, drawn especially to his articulate daughter, who had chosen, it was a choice with her, an expression of her own freedom, who had chosen to wear a handsome headscarf. I realized, or rather realized once again, that Islam has many shades and that even fundamentalism casts shadows of different hues. Let me say at once that I am not Islamic or Muslim at all. If anything, I'm a kind of cheerful nihilist, really. So, I put this to you now without proof. A kind of Islam is struggling to wrench itself from the legacies of both foreign colonialism and native extremism. And this struggle, and in this struggle, women will play a crucial, perhaps the decisive part. This Islam may reject violence, but it has a will of its own, make no mistake about that. It's indifferent to Western approval, to the liberal Western point of view. So much for Victoria's secret. 6. But what about fundamentalism in the West, in America particularly? As in all things concerning my country, the story is outlandish and contradictory, defying generalization. In his tract of the 17th century, a tract called A Model of Christian Society, written on the good ship Arabella on the high seas, Governor John Winthrop did envisage a city on the hill. The phrase, incidentally, you can find in the Gospel according to St. Matthew. He did envisage a city on the hill, and though Winthrop's city on the hill excluded the Red Indians, it assumed a Christian brotherhood in the savage New World. Since then, the statistics about believers and churchgoers in America and its evangelical rhetoric, the evangelical rhetoric of America, has repelled large parts of the world. But that rhetoric should take its place beside other rhetorics and other idioms. The founding fathers were rational deists and Freemasons. The great 19th century writers, Hawthorne and Melville, Thoreau and Emerson, Twain and James, were skeptics, nihilists, transcendentalists, humanists, and not even God knows what Emily Dickinson was. Still, I think Whitman was right to say the core of democracy in America is religion. The core of democracy in America is religion, a sentiment I fear that the current president misprisions. The religious right may be hijacking classic conservatism, national politics, and foreign policy today, but the reaction to it has already declared itself in recent elections, and in books like Daniel Dennett's Breaking the Spell, Sam Harris' Letter to a Christian Nation, Christopher Hitchens' God is Not Great. And according to one Harris poll, the percentage of adult Americans who are not absolutely certain about the existence of God has risen from 34% 3 years ago to 42% today. We all cite polls without believing in them, don't we? So forget that statistic. The United States, however, remains a creedal nation, no doubt about that. Whether the creed is Christianity, the Constitution, the pursuit of happiness, or greed is good. And creeds often whisper some universal truth. But who knows what the creed will be when America becomes a Catholic, quasi-Hispanic nation in 50 or 70 years. So, We're almost at the midpoint, so let me turn to literature now, turn away from politics and its rough grain. Is literature that old smoothie innocent of absolutism, of fundamentalism? Hardly. In the beginning was the Word, John said, you remember, and the Word, the Logos, was with God. What could be more basic or definitive? Well, that was then, you say. Not really, only two decades ago, in another faith, the word of death went out against Salman Rushdie in the famous fatwa. And even the Magus of Deconstruction, this is the French philosopher, the late French philosopher Jacques Derrida, recognized the inherent ethnocentrism, as he called it, and inherent imperialism, as he put it, of the word. It's not just deconstruction, it's not just a French philosopher like that. We know that in Mesopotamia, Egypt, China, India, agrarian empires devised cuneiforms, hieroglyphs, ideograms, letters, and numbers to centralize power, organize armies, control time, distribute water, weigh grain, and yes, oppress people. The chisel, the stylus, the quill, the reed, the pen, the abacus were tools of tyranny, no less than the dripping sword. Of course, there's another side to the matter. The earliest stories, the first myths and founding narratives and sacred texts were also ontological statements affirming our being and our existence against death, against the void, against the frailty and contingency of human existence. They were shield against despair. And so men and women lived by the word and also died by the word, freed and tyrannized by the so-called letter. 8. Yes, but what about literature itself, you ask? Not letters, but literature. I want to suggest that a strain of fundamentalism, a tendency for spiritual absolutism, runs through Western literature itself, not just through sacred texts or fanatic hearts. Think of Milton's Lucifer, Blake Steiger, Goethe's Faust, Byron's Manfred, Melville's Ahab, L'Otriamon's Maldoror, as well as countless intellectual adventurers and breakneck nihilists who populate the works of Turgenev, Dostoevsky, Conrad, Mann, Gide, Kafka, Faulkner, Hemingway, Beckett, and so on. I leave it to you in this audience to decide if the author of Vos belongs in this company or not. What I mean to say, though, is that the shadow of romantic absolutism, of spiritual extremism, falls on modern literature. But I would not want to exorcise that shadow, for it defines a certain kind of energy, a high distinctive trait of the imagination. Shall we call that trait idealism again? Yes, idealism, however bent or twisted, trailing the dust of dreams. 9. I said bent or twisted casually, but I could have also said grotesque. An American literary tradition of the Gothic and the grotesque goes back to the novelist Charles Brockden Brown. He was born in 1771. Goes back even earlier to the divine Jonathan Edwards, whose sermons are finally saved from the grotesque by the Puritan habit of self-examination. The tradition includes Poe and Hawthorne, Faulkner and Sherwood Anderson, Carson McCullers and Flannery O'Connor, all the way to the present, to Cormac McCarthy, let's say, whose bodacious villain in the novel called No Country for Old Men is a case unto himself. But the key passage, I think, that will clarify for you the grotesque comes from something called the Book of the Grotesque in Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio, which was written or published in 1919. And I quote the relevant passage from the Book of the Grotesque. In the beginning, when the world was young, there were a great many thoughts, but no such thing as a truth. It was the truths that made the people grotesques. The moment one of the people took one of the truths to himself, called it his truth, and tried to live his life by it, he became a grotesque, and the truth he embraced became a falsehood. Isn't that a remarkable passage? It seems to me that this passage describes uncannily the character of religious fundamentalists of our own day, their grotesque obsessions and distortions of the spirit, the violence of their alienation from this world. 10. Actually, great literature describes nothing at all. It doesn't mirror the world as so many people, including great Aristotle, think. What literature does is to give us a feeling, an experience, an interpretation, a question, a model of the world, as no concept or system or dogma can. In fact, and that's the flip side of what I said about the imperialism of the letter, in fact, literature, like all the arts, subverts authority. Like David Malouf's Ovid, the poet ends up in Dacia for his irreverent pains. It's an old story, really. Plato banished the poets from his republic. Understandably, the poets took a different view. And so Sir Philip Sidney, in the 16th century, for instance, understood that the poet nothing affirms and therefore never lieth. John Keats described or celebrated something called negative capability, that is the power to remain in uncertainties. I'm using Keats's words, the power to remain in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without irritable reaching after fact and reason. A power that Shakespeare displayed peerlessly. But I'm not about to drag you into the bogs of literary history. All I want to say is that literature is the banana peel on which all fundamentalisms slip. Still, absolutism always picks itself up again and strides forth in our midst, because there is a fundamentalist within each of us. 11. And so I must return to the present, alas, the present and its manifold miseries. A specter is haunting the world. We meet it every time we board a plane. How can literature, how can any art assuage those terrible passions wearing the kafia or turban, or toting and quoting the book? The media won't help. The media, in fact, both expose absolutism and extend its grasp. They do more than that. They prescribe terror, write its scenarios ahead of time. Indeed, the media preempt the terrorist himself, who simply acts out, with some variations, the theater of public fantasies and media cliches. So what can avail? Political and economic solutions may take us part of the way. But Imperial America can go up in flames today, vanish into the stratosphere without pacifying the fanatic heart. The insulted and the injured will have their say, however self-inflicted their wounds. The repressed returns with a violence wholly disproportionate to its cause. What can avail? 12. Science will not take us very far toward answering this query. As the adage goes, science tells us how the heavens go, religion how to go to heaven. But evolutionary science is currently engaged in an interesting, if inconclusive, debate about gods and religions. From a Darwinian perspective, the right question is, why do human beings believe in gods? Not, do gods exist? The right question from a Darwinian point of view is, why do human beings believe in gods? Not, do gods exist? Put another way, are religions a useful adaptation in the evolution of our race, or are they an accidental byproduct of evolution? Imputing agency seems to be an innate impulse of the clever biped, that's you and me. So is explanatory narrative, otherwise known as myth. So is projection, attributing our thoughts and feelings to external objects. All these give us, or rather gave us once, an advantage in survival. So argues Darwinian science, so to speak. But now, what do they do for you and me? Console us when we are disconsolate, remind us of the glories of Karnak, Angkor Wat, Chach, and the great mosque in Cordoba, rehearse for us horrors unending in the name of gods. What do they do for us? Passion and need, especially need, are required to make all those gods speak. Your passion, your need, my passion, my need, are required to make these gods speak, to make all those stones breathe. We seem to be born with the facility to believe, however absurdly, as we are born with the capacity to make sense of the world with those arbitrary sounds called language. But when it comes to knowing God, we bang against a cognitive wall. We need faith. It's not really a wall, it's a void, a gap that faith overleaps. So what has all this to do with fundamentalism and literature? 13. As you can see, I'm approaching 15th, the 15th rock. 13. We now come to a very small rock, a gem, really more than a rock. It's a line from the notebooks of Franz Kafka, the writer Franz Kafka. The line goes like this. The spirit becomes free only when it ceases to be a support. The spirit becomes free only when it ceases to be a support. I interpret this to mean the gods come to life only when we cease to need them. Here fundamentalism ends and literature begins. 14. Of course, as I've suggested, none of the arts can bring about a deep change of heart. With genetic engineering, I shudder. And so I return to that garden in Ryoanji without despair. Visitors there tend to depart from that garden calm of mind. The calm is transient, but real, as a rock is real. The pattern of 15 rocks, however, wavers in the inner eye, leaving no distinct impression or form. When you go out of that garden, you cannot reconstruct in your mind the shape of these 15 rocks. It's amazing. The form, the visitor suddenly realizes, is empty, like the spaces between the rocks. It's this emptiness I want to offer my silent antagonist, the fundamentalist within. Without self-dispossession, without self-emptying, without what theologians call kenosis, fear and craving persist, and absolutism will continue to reign. Remember Kafka's line, spirit soars only when it ceases to serve human beings as a crutch. 15 and last. If this conclusion about self-emptying, about self-dispossession, and about fundamentalism seems to you too elusive, then let me leave you with a very short and very earthy line from Don Quixote in that famous episode of the windmills. The line goes like this. What giants, said Sancho Panza, what giants? Indeed, what giants? This, in conclusion, may suffice for tonight. Thank you.
Many thanks, Dr. Hassan. David Malouf. And I'm sorry, I should have said earlier, just be careful that you don't...
I'm touching nothing. I'm going to get near him. Again, I'm also very happy to be here at the Sydney Institute. As Jared said, I gave that, I think, inaugural Adler lecture a long time ago.
But it lives on in the Sydney papers.
The long century and a half from the 1840s to the 1980s was a period when fiercely idealistic notions of how society might be organised and the souls of men and women engineered and changed became a prime subject of argument and of reformist political action. It was an impulse that appealed at its best not only to the noblest minds among us, but to our noblest instincts, to compassion, altruism, a wish to end the hunger and suffering of the millions, a longing for justice and equality in a plainly unjust and unequal world. We hear the voice of all this in Alyosha Karamazov's determination to be a warrior for life, but also, with some not-so-gentle satire, in the mixture of wistfulness and ineffectual optimism with which Chekhov's characters in Uncle Vanya and the Three Sisters declare their willingness to sacrifice their own lives now for the beautiful lives, as they put it, that people will live 100 years from now. The classic case is Alyosha Karamazov's brother, Ivan. What comes up immediately in him is the connection between political action and the loss of faith. Ivan Karamazov is a believer who can no longer accept God's world, specifically the sufferings of innocent children, and has decided, as he puts it, to return his ticket. In the fable he tells Alyosha, the Grand Inquisitor, he speaks of what Jesus, under temptation from Satan, rejected, but which we might have to accept, that man cares more for bread than for freedom, and following from that, the implementation of an order, in this case by the church, but looking forward prophetically to the Stalinist, fascist and Nazi states of the next century, and to every other totalitarian regime, where the authorities deceive their citizens with mysteries for their own good, and imprison and execute all those who oppose their rule, but do provide their subjects with bread, and relieve them, the totalitarian state's great gift, of the burden of being individual and free. Much of what was to be history written in millions of lives over the next century is spelled out in the bitter ironies of Ivan Karamazov's exemplary tale. The use of brutal means to pure and useful ends, the call upon Alyosha Karamazov's warriors of life to commit great crimes and bear the eternal ignominy of them. This was the argument put by SS leaders to the more idealistic of their recruits for the sake of future generations. Behind these new ideas was a belief that human beings could be changed and therefore must be changed, if necessary, against their own stubborn or misguided will. And they could be changed because in the old argument between nature and nurture, the balance had tilted decisively to nurture. There was no such thing now as human nature. Men were shaped by conditions. Change the conditions and you create a new kind of man. And there was one other new notion abroad, that the primary force behind culture, behind history, was energy, expressing itself in psychological terms as intensity. It was the addition of intensity to this commitment to change that pushed all these noble warriors for life towards fanatical extremes. The late 17th and 18th century had put its faith in reason, in reasonableness. The later 18th century turned that on its head. It saw in disorder and change the natural expression of man's aspiring energy. This turning to the creative possibilities of unreason is wonderfully embodied in a Goya etching of 1798. The sleep of reason produces monsters. I don't know if people know that etching. What exactly, one wonders, is this image suggesting? That if we allow reason to lapse, what will be let loose are monsters? Or that reason itself, or what men think of as reason, is where monsters are bred? An early evocation, is that how we are to take it, of that underside of reason that in the next century will be where all that is most fearful and creative and deeply hidden, but also most revealing and influential in us, has its source? Perhaps what Goya had in mind in 1798 was the recent revolution in France and that darkest and most backward product of the Enlightenment, the Terror. The turning of what had in August 89 been revolutionary idealism at its brightest to the mob violence of the September massacres and then the institutionalized exemplary violence of 1793. This last, we might note, at the very moment when reason was set up in the Pantheon and on the field of Mars as the supreme being. By now, intensity, which earlier under its own bold name of enthusiasm had been a doubtful quality, a sign of dangerous excess and even a synonym for madness, had become the purest and most energetic form of being. The new hero of the age is the enragé, the artist David, for example. For the 4 years from 1789 to the fall of Robespierre in 1793, David, who had previously been a neoclassical artist, politically committed but essentially cool, rushes about in a state of pure revolutionary fury, organises propaganda shows and official days of celebration, produces the great iconic images of the revolution, the death of Marat is only the best known, makes inflammatory speeches, serves on committees, hunts down and denounces fellow artists and other enemies of the people, though he does save Fragonard, and signs more arrest warrants than Robespierre. David is the first example we have of the artist as activist, an exponent of the belief that art should be a vehicle of political action because art and politics are embodiments of the same energy, the same will to make it new, and that only art that serves the right sort of action, art that is on the side of history, can be good. So much for the nexus out of which modern fundamentalism, ideological fanaticism, arises, and the belief in its own necessity and purity that sustains it. Essentially, all fundamentalists are religious, even when the form they take is political. The real religion, Bakunin tells us, lies in political action and the struggle. What then of the role of the writer in all of this? How useful are writers as ideologues, as carriers of the one true belief? I want to begin by making a distinction between kinds of writing. Writing that deals with an issue or idea in the hope of persuading the reader and changing things, and writing whose interest is in living itself. The first sort of writing knows what it means to say before it begins, because the writer already has an opinion. The second sets out to discover what it might have to say, and the further it goes, the more qualifications and contradictions it takes in, the less chance it has of coming to a conclusion. The first kind of writing is that of the journalist, the moralist, the reformer, the preacher, the polemicist, and of course it can be extremely useful. But even if it is very successful, think of Uncle Tom's Cabin, and does real good, it will remain alive only as long as the issue it takes up has a hold on our interest. Sometimes a writer begins with an issue, Dickens, for instance, in Nicholas Nickleby, then something else takes over. A larger interest seizes him, life itself in all its irrelevant but engaging detail. As Henry James tells us, a fiction writer's only duty is to be interesting. So what about this second sort of writer, the one who is engaged, interested, by pretty well everything, in fact, that has no convictions, does not know, never knows, till the writing itself has said it, what he thinks? Keats, in writing of Shakespeare, gives as good a description as we are likely to get of this sort of writer and his mode of being. He hath as mentioned him. Negative capability, he calls it. That is, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. What Keats sees as essential to this sort of writer is a passive withdrawal of the ego, of the consciousness, in favour of absolute presence in all its contradictory and puzzling otherness of what is being observed, delight in its complexity, its enlivening singularities and contradictions. This dead butcher and his fiend-like queen is how Malcolm describes Macbeth and Lady Macbeth in a memorable soundbite at the end of the play. And this view of them might very well serve the man who has now to establish his authority and restore order to the world. But for those of us who've actually seen these people and know them from within, it's entirely inadequate. A butcher, yes, but also a man of delicate moral conscience, which he has had to fight hard to deny. Not a natural butcher. And a woman who goes against her own truer self, denatures herself, to be, as Malcolm puts it, fiend-like, and pays the price. Falstaff, in the two paths of Henry IV, is from the beginning an impossible character, an irreconcilable element if what we are dedicated to is a state of real social order in which the weak are protected and the law is to be kept. But when Prince Hal denies him, "Old man, I know thee not, in the name of good governance and the higher needs of the state, we rebel." A world without Falstaff, without his wit, his extravagance, his anarchic individuality, is a world we do not want to live in. Shakespeare leaves the dilemma unresolved, because except for politicians who deal with the negotiable and professors of ethics, it is not resolvable, not if we are to remain human. Shakespeare, like any writer, goes where the energy is, where the interest is, or where Iago is, or Richard III, and we go with him. In the same way, Milton, as Shelley puts it, is at the devil's party. Milton, too, acts as a writer and goes clean against what we know he believes. We see the same force at work in Balzac. His great character in the human comedy, as he calls the body of his fictions, is the ex-convict Vautrin. Yet another embodiment, like Balzac himself, of that new force in society, the self-made man of destiny, the pocket of Bonaparte. Vautrin, former galley slave, homosexual, skilled manipulator of other men, and avenger of his own and his fellow convicts' mistreatment by a corrupt and hypocritical society, becomes for Balzac the agent of his own capacity to be everywhere in the world he is creating. So Vautrin becomes, as it suits him, con man, dandified man about town, seducer of attractive but penniless young men who will be his agents in destroying women and the society that has unmanned him, cardinal, police informer, and with typical Balzacian effrontery, the chief of police himself. A force in a society made vulnerable by its own amorality, for exposing the cynical heartlessness, as the Marxist critic Georg Lukács sees it, of the mid-century capitalist world. In fact, we know what Balzac believed. He was a right-wing Catholic monarchist. But Balzac, the writer, is a free radical with no affiliations and commitments. The book that more than any other work of the 19th century charts the rise of political activism in the 1840s to 60s is Dostoevsky's The Possessed, or The Demons, as more recent translators call it. Written out of an angry contempt for all liberal reformers and activists, all future phalanteries and atheistical apostles of freedom, it is in turn comic, satirical, tender, grotesque, grandly tragic, and astonishingly prophetic. As the demons of its title, which are ideas, theories, fanatical idealisms, invade the minds of men and turn them, as the epigraph makes clear, into Gadarene swine rushing headlong to destruction. But mere satire or polemic is impossible to the writer in Dostoevsky. Each character, as Dostoevsky enters him, emerges as a victim. Kirillov, Shatov, most of all the great singer, Stavrogin. Only the contemptible Verkhovensky, venomous gadfly and mischief maker, cold-blooded theoretician of universal destruction, who's based on the nihilist Nechayev. And the offspring in the book, both symbolically and in fact, of the old-style liberal dilettante and 50-year-old infant, Stepan Trofimovich, K. cannot be included in Dostoevsky's view of the forgivably human. No other writer takes on so fully as Dostoevsky the burden of the suffering creatures. Ivan Karamazov's children, the bairn of Dmitri Karamazov's dream, Raskolnikov's fallen cart horse. And no writer doubts more darkly the principles that have been offered up, the movements that have arisen and been murderously implemented for its solution. Once again, like Shakespeare, having laid out the conditions, Dostoevsky leaves us with a dilemma that is not to be resolved. He holds to the newest principle of universal destruction, Liputin tells Stepan Trofimovich admiringly of the suicidal bridge builder and would-be new man Kirillov. For the sake of good final goals, he's already demanded more than 100 million heads in order to establish common sense throughout Europe. Those 100 million heads would eventually be forthcoming, of course. No problem. The sleep of reason does indeed produce monsters. Dostoevsky's Demons provides us not only with a close study of a whole range of fanatical types, but an analysis of the psychological and philosophical sources of what he calls the theoretical disease. Most typical of him and his rightly orientation is his recognition of a quality of absurdity here that pushes the writing towards grotesque farce without at all compromising the reality of the violence his young fanatics are driven to or the threat they represent. Compared with this, most later day attempts to deal with the terrorist mind, even Conrad's, seem superficial. The greatness of the secret agent is not in Conrad's rather shabby and ineffectual conspirators, but in Mr. Verloc's wife, the motherly and vengeful Winnie, who once again is driven to action by the death of an innocent child. The rest are fakes like Verloc himself. And the old terrorist and tamed and toothless lion of the drawing room, Michaelis. Only the professor is truly dangerous. He is a psychopath. But if all terrorists are foolish theorists or psychopaths like the professor, we can sleep pretty safely in our beds. Closer surely to what we know of modern practices of propagandist murders, the members of the Red Brigades in Italy, or the Baader-Meinhof organisation, or the perpetrators of 9/11, are Dostoevsky's young men, educated, idealistic, pure in motive, determinately inhuman, going unrecognised among us like the London bombers because they are so entirely unremarkable. We see them in the video messages they leave, full of both anger and compassionate love. And ready, they too speak of the deaths of innocent children, Palestinian children in this case, to perform indiscriminate murder in the name of a greater good. They are not psychopaths. If what they do suggests it, they are psychopaths by conviction and choice. Such characters are fascinating to writers and always have been. From Marlowe's Tamburlaine and the Jew of Malta, Shakespeare's Iago and Edmund and Richard III, to Satan and Vautrin. But these characters have one other characteristic beyond their energy and single-mindedness that is not at all common, I'd suggest, in their real-life counterparts. All these characters are dark comedians, and they catch this quality, which goes so strangely with their fundamentalist view, this sense of the ultimate absurdity of things from their creators, who as writers cannot resist it, even when in real life terms it does not fit. This constitutes a kind of charm that brings these characters, however monstrous they may be, within human understanding, an uneasy recognition and acceptance, as their real life counterparts are not. The inability to regard themselves ironically sets a Nechayev or a Hitler or Stalin in a different class altogether from a Richard III. The capacity for human humorous distance is what prevents the writer from from accepting energy and interest as the only criteria for judgment. The mind that cannot free itself of its own preoccupations, that is dominated by a single idea, is one we cannot accept, and which the writer's other mind, fluid, questioning, reversible, by encouraging us as readers to delight in its capacity for flexibility and surprise, leads us by example to reject.